once again. Many civilian and military personnel have now returned to offices they occupied before the attack. The Pentagon is a working building, not a memorial. Yet the memories of a great tragedy linger here. And for all who knew loss here, life is not the same. The 184 whose lives were taken in this place, veterans and recruits, soldiers and civilians, husbands and wives, parents and children, left behind family and friends whose loss cannot be weighed. The murder of innocents cannot be explained, only endured. And though they died in tragedy, they did not die in vain. Their loss has moved a nation to action in a cause to defend other innocent lives across the world. This war is waged on many fronts. We've captured more than 2,000 terrorists. A larger number of killers have met their end in combat. We've seized millions in terrorist assets. We're reorganizing the federal government to protect the homeland. Yet there's a great deal left to do. And the greatest tasks and the greatest dangers will fall to the armed forces of the United States. I came to the presidency with respect for all who wear America's uniform every day. Every day, as your Commander-in-Chief, my respect and that of our nation has deepened. I have great confidence in every man and woman who wears the uniform of the United States of America. I am proud of all who have fought on my orders. And this nation honors all who died in our cause. Wherever our military is sent in the world, you bring hope and justice and promise of a better day. You are worthy of the traditions you represent, the uniform you wear, the ideals you serve. America is counting on you, and our confidence is well placed. What happened to our nation on a September day set in motion the first great struggle of a new century. The enemies who struck us are determined, and they're resourceful. They will not be stopped by a sense of decency or a hint of conscience, but they will be stopped. A greater force is amassed against them. They are opposed by freedom-loving people in many lands. They are opposed by our allies who have fought bravely by our side. And as long as terrorists and dictators plot against our lives and our liberty, they will be opposed by the United States Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Air Force, and Marines. We fight as Americans have always fought, not just for ourselves, but for the security of our friends and for peace in the world. We fight for the dignity of life against fanatics who feel no shame in murder. We fight to protect the innocent so that the lawless and the merciless will not inherit the earth. At every turn of this war, we will always remember how it began and who fell first. The thousands who went to work, boarded a plane, or reported to their post. Today, the nation pays our respects to them. Here, and in Pennsylvania, and in New York, we honor each name and each life. We ask God to bring comfort to every home where they are loved and missed. And on this day, and on every day, may He watch over the United States of America. God bless.
President George Bush talking of this day as a day of remembrance, a day of renewal of a commitment to the war on terrorism. The president speaking at the Pentagon Memorial, his emphasis very clearly because of that location on the U.S. military response of the last year. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to Connection's special coverage of September 11th, 1 year later. On the anniversary of the day, it gives us a chance to think back to how it was we got here. We'll be talking throughout the next couple of hours to people in Pennsylvania, New York, and noting the memorials around the world. The president asked us to remember how it all began. Well, here are some of the sounds of this hour 1 year ago.
Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
These incidents occurred about an hour ago, Eastern Time. The FBI is investigating whether the planes were hijacked.
I was just evacuated from the Pentagon along with the thousands of other people who worked there.
At 9:41, of course, the president's not here this morning. At 9:41, the word went out from the White House, everybody out. They evacuated the press that was there.
Our building is a block east of the Trade Towers, and I did see the explosions. We can not even see the top of the Trade Towers where the fire is. He thinks one is not there anymore. Oh, God, you can probably see it better than I can.
One of the towers of the World Trade Center appears to have completely collapsed. This is a 110-story building. Each of the two towers is 110 stories high.
Now I can see one tower. The North Tower is still standing, but the South Tower disappeared because for a moment, just one thing... Just not here anymore.
Connection listeners, we're interested in your reflections on this day. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We will talk with a good number of people through the next couple of hours. Principal among them, two in New York, Richard Bernstein. He's a New York Times reporter, book critic, and author most recently of the book Out of the Blue. It is, as described on the jacket, the story of September 11th from Jihad to Ground Zero. Reverend Dr. James A. Forbes, Jr. is also with us. He's senior minister at the Riverside Church in New York. It's a non-denominational church with a history of great preaching. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Reverend Forbes, listening to the sounds of 1 year ago and reflecting back on your own words of that time when you told people to trust your body to bring you through, don't be so hard on yourself. If the body says it's crying time, go ahead. Where are we now?
I think, in a sense, we are getting an opportunity to discover that in many ways, last year is still with us. We've worked our way through the initial shock waves, but something of the sensitivity and the new vulnerability is still inside of us. And I think we are attempting to sort of let that happen, to feel it again, and to know that this time we have discovered that we have been sustained, we have come through, and we think we will find the strength to move on, whatever the future might hold.
Richard, you were telling one of our producers a day or so ago that there's a part of you that's a little uncomfortable with the focus on the pain and the suffering that anniversaries sometimes bring and zero in on.
Oh, I'm not uncomfortable with the suffering and pain at all. I think it's natural, as the Reverend Forbes says, to re-experience it and also to remember that the tragedy afflicted 3,000 unique individuals and their families. We should never allow these numbers to become so abstract that we forget that people like us were affected. What I simply wanted to my concern is that we not I don't know what the word is to bathe so much in our grief and in our pride also in the way we responded to this tragedy, that we forget to learn some practical and hard and concrete lessons about where it came from, what mistakes we made in failing to see it come, and in failing to appreciate the magnitude of the force of evil that struck us. So that we have to learn something from this experience. We have to learn something about the world and the way the world works and the way history works, and not just re-experience our collective grief.
Dr. Forbes, do we learn something, as Richard's suggesting, by the listening to the names that's underway in New York City? I'm struck by the power of the simple reciting of the names of the people there.
At the end of every tragic moment, there is a life. And although we list them and we name them at seriatim, each life is an individual life. And to the extent that we name each one, maybe that's the message. God looks down upon the sparrow that falls. God sees each individual, and I suspect family members see not only the mass of those destroyed in that great, great calamity that we will remember in infamy forever, but that they see that one closest and nearest. I think then we have a combination, individuality and also our solidarity with the whole of the ones lost that day, but with people around the world who suffer violence day by day. So I think it's the right combination. Never forget the individual, but also remember that we are a globe and that there's suffering around the globe. If we can keep both of those in mind, we will probably be ready to face whatever the future will hold.
We're going to go back to Ground Zero, New York City, just to listen to some of the names as they continue to be read from the podium there.
Stephen Mercado.
Wesley Mercer.
Ralph Joseph Mercurio.
Alan Harvey.
Hey, Chuck, is it important for you to be in New York?
It's important for me to be here, and let me just digress for one moment. The Reverend is quite correct. It is still the crying time. To walk through the throngs of family members who are here, you learn that early and often. But I am here as a proxy for Frank's family and his friends. His wife is up in Canada with her children, where she should be. His mother is back in Detroit, where he grew up. And I am his representative here today for his family and his good friend, and probably his best friend, Dave Unetti, who was not here and could not be here for personal reasons.
Chuck, what is it that you would have us know about Frank? Brian
Monahan. What I would have you know about Frank briefly is that he would have been the greatest father this world has ever seen. He was a tough guy from Detroit. He was a hockey player who put himself through school on a hockey scholarship and then went to Wall Street and climbed to the very top. And he was a tough guy when he had to be, but he was seriously loyal and loving. But above all that, he was a father, and he was a guy who revolved around his daughter the way a planet revolves around the sun. It was something, it was almost funny for me to watch. I loved watching him with her. He would dissolve around her. His then little, two-year-old little girl, Zoe, was the light of his life, and his little boy, Garrett, was right behind her. So I guess I'd have you know that. He was a sweet guy, my best friend, and probably about the greatest dad and husband husband to his lovely wife, Kimmy, that anybody could imagine.
Chuck, you began by saying that you were listening to Dr. Forbes speaking before you on the program. He was just listening to you talk about your friend. Dr. Forbes, I'll let you speak directly to Chuck, if you will.
Chuck, you know, your spirit is still attached to your departed friend. And one of the most important things to do is to try to bring your body as close as you can to where your spirit is. So I think you're in the right place today. And although being there will not relieve the pain of the loss, it at least gives you a sense of wholeness, a place of solidarity, body, mind, and spirit. And I think your friend would discover that's the meaning of true friendship, being there where you can be with all that there is within you, honoring the past and hoping to find strength to carry on in the spirit of the one who meant so much to you. I'm glad you are there, and may you find strength, brother, as you go throughout this day and the days
Thank
to come.
Thank you, Reverend. And I can't exactly tell you why, but I'll tell you this. It feels right. I knew for a long time that I would be here this morning, and it feels right.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Mathers, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Chuck Mathers in New York, listening to the names being read, names of the victims of the World Trade Center bombing.
O'Neill Mawad.
Christopher Mozillo.
Stephen Vincent Muldery.
Richard Muldowney Jr.
Michael D. Mullen.
Dennis Michael Mulligan.
Peter James Mulligan.
Michael Joseph Mullen.
James Donald Munhall.
Nancy Muñiz.
Carlos Munoz.
Frank Munoz.
Teresa Munson.
You may recognize
Robert
one of the
M.
voices there reading
Rock.
The names. It's Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Augusto Murillo.
Mark A. Marullo.
James F. Murphy IV.
Brian Joseph Murphy.
Charles Anthony Murphy.
Christopher W. Murphy.
Edward Charles Murphy.
James Thomas Murphy.
Robert Eddie Murphy Jr.
Kevin James Murphy.
Patrick C. Murphy.
Raymond E. Murphy.
John Joseph Murray.
John Joseph Murray Jr.
Susan D. Murray.
Valerie Victoria Murray.
Richard Todd Meyer.
Robert B. Nagel.
Mildred Naiman.
Takuya Nakamura.
Alexander Napier.
Frank Joseph Naples III.
John Napolitano.
Caterine Ann Nardella.
Mario Nardone Jr.
Monica K. Narula.
Mahmoud Nassim.
Sean M. Nassane.
Narendra Nath.
Karen Susan Navarro.
Joseph Michael Navas.
Francis Joseph Nazario.
Glenroy I. Neblett.
Raymond Marcus Neblett. Mom misses you.
Jerome O. Ned.
Lawrence Nedell.
Luke G. Nee.
Pete Negron.
Connection listeners, my name is Dick Gordon. This hour we're marking moments of this day last year. It was, in fact, at this moment last year that the second of the World Trade Center towers, the North Tower, collapsed from the top down. And a few moments from now, we'll be hearing bells ring in New York City to mark that moment. The bells will ring as the names continue to be read. And in fact, it's a moment where churches across the country have been encouraged to participate. So roll your car window down, open your window. You may hear the bell ringing in your own hometown. Back now to New York City.
Niccolo.
Kathleen Ann DeCasco.
Martin S. Nidera.
Alfonso Joseph.
Remarkable, the power of sound. Listening to all the bells ring at one time was like one wall of sound, with the one bell we heard ringing, a shiny brass bell being rung by a Marine right at the center of the ceremony that's being held in New York at the site of the World Trade Center Tower. Our reporter, Robin Young, is there and on the line. Robin, I may be mistaken, but I could hear the sound of people at the same time as those bells were being rung, crying in the background.
You're not mistaken. That was an incredibly powerful moment. People just froze in their tracks. Up until that moment, I have to say there was a lightness that was happening here. The most profound moment this morning was at 8:46 when the first moment of silence happened, and it was as if there was just this great unleashing of grief. People just, it's like something broke, and then, of course, the names began, the A's, and you just had that sense of, oh, my God, there's, you know, 198 pages of names to be read. There was just this outpouring of grief. In the last few minutes, there's almost that, you know, predictable sort of lightness that follows that, and people have been chatting, but it's at 10:29, again, when those bells happened, I mean, people just froze again and raised flags and hugged, and, you know, I saw people coming up out of the pit. Some of the family members are leaving, and, you know, they just stood where they were and held pictures up. A fire engine went by. Right now there's a color guard walking by also. People are just frozen. People are saluting a color guard that's walking by us right now.
And nobody's going anywhere.
Well, I tell you, the only movement is that there are people that have had to leave this pit because this incredible windstorm, you know, this is a 16-acre wound cut into the city, and so the wind is just whipping through, and you know, the dust, I've mentioned it before, but you can't say it enough because it's so evocative, you know, and so there are some people, actually I saw a woman who had to be carried out, it just seemed to be overcome But most people, you know, in this moment again have just sort of frozen. And the people that have come here, Dick, I've been so struck. I just want to mention, you talked to the person who came to hear a name. There have been many of those people that we've talked to, people who were in the building and got out. But I've been struck with the international turnout. In one walk down a barricade, there was a couple that, an elderly couple that flew from Scotland just to be here, a woman who drove all night from Canada, another couple from Argentina. They didn't speak any English, and they just sort of said, had to be here. There's a group of bobbies from England who've come. There's this tremendous international flair. And then, you know, there's steel workers and iron workers walking among the well-dressed family members who are, you know, coming to what for many of them is a funeral.
Robin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dick.
Robin is host of Here and Now. It's a Noontime News magazine program out of Boston WBUR. And reporting for us live from the site of the World Trade Center Tower in New York City. I'd mentioned a little bit earlier, we have Dr. Forbes and Richard Bernstein with us on the program this hour. Richard is the author of a book, Out of the Blue. It is a book that he has written using, Richard, I guess, all the work of all the New York Times reporters who've been covering this story for the past year.
Yes, that's right. And also, I drew on material that appeared in other publications,
right.
The Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times and the Wall Street Journal and others, and some of my own reporting, especially on the people who are most directly affected, the victims and their families, people who escaped, and also reporting some of my own experience in the past, reporting on terrorism in Egypt and Pakistan, going back to the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. So it's my co-author, there's a co-author listed on the book. It's called The Staff of the New York Times,
right.
And it doesn't get much better than that.
The juxtaposition that you use in the very specific detail of the people who brought the planes as these missiles of death and the people who suffered as a result of that was something that struck me in your decision to construct it out of specific people looking directly at their lives.
Well, I'm glad that did strike you because it's exactly what I wanted to do. As I said before, there is always a risk in an event where many lives were taken to substitute a sort of abstract number for the human reality. I didn't want that to happen in Out of the Blue. I wanted to be sure that the human reality was always at the center of the narrative. I'm struck, actually, listening to the names a minute ago. The T's are some time away, but one of the victims is a woman named Zanetta Choi, T-S-O-Y, whose story was always especially moving to me. And I talk about her in the very beginning of the book in juxtaposition to Osama bin Laden. Zanetta Choi was an immigrant from Kazakhstan, a predominantly Muslim country, although I don't know if she was a Muslim herself or not. She had won a lottery, an immigration lottery, to come to the United States. She arrived with her family, her husband and her small daughter, Sasha, 5 years old, and she got a job at Marsh & McLennan, the insurance company in the Trade Center, and she was going to her first day of work. And because she was eager to make a good impression on this, the first day of the rest of her life, she arrived early. She arrived, I don't know exactly what time she arrived, but she was there at 8:46, and she didn't have to be there until 9 o'clock. She left home without having breakfast. And she died. And they're telling her daughter, Sasha, that her mother went on a long trip and they don't know when she'll be back. And I juxtapose that with the tape that we have of Osama bin Laden and some of his people talking about the Trade Center disaster.
I remember it distinctly, gesturing with his hand, how the plane...
Gesturing with hand and laughing about it. And I say, in talking about Sasha Choi, a little girl that I don't know, I've never met her, that someday when she grows up and she knows what happens to her mother, she'll wonder what those men were laughing about. And what were those men thinking? What kind of person would think that they were doing God's work because that's what they said, that they were doing God's work in murdering Zanetta Choi. That's the human juxtaposition that I wanted to make clear in this book.
Dr. Forbes, you're senior minister of the Riverside Church, and it's been a year where a lot of people have called on spiritual leaders to give them a little bit of guidance. I wonder if you can speak to us a minute how you see this day from a personal point of view. Is there a name that will be read that will mean something to you? Do you experience a day like this as almost two people, one in your formal role as minister and another as Jim Forbes?
You know, as a preacher, the first way I experience it is not as an official leader, but even my heart and my spirit, I think, responded to that day. And I have said to clergy, those of us who serve, and also to public health officials, we ourselves are victims in many different ways, and we bear the scars inside our own minds. And as I look back over this year, it's been very tough. Of course, we've had to try to minister at memorial services, and we've tried to help other people. But, you know, this event has struck at the heart of all peace-loving people around the world, and I'm one of them. But also, there are very special situations, and the fascinating thing for me is how little by little you discover people with whom you had closer associations who were involved. Just this morning, I was told that one of the persons whose name will be called today was one of my students when I was doing a course at Harvard Divinity School. I did not learn until this morning that Andrew Rice is going to have his name called. Night before last, I was talking with a friend out in Oregon who says he has not told most people that he was in an office across from the World Trade Center, and the engine of one of those planes landed in his office. Somehow he managed to get out. Little by little, we discover how the ripples of this awful moment extend further and further, and then closer and closer. There are members of my congregation who were involved in one way or the other. And sometimes even those who survived bear scars, and it's possible to see in them the continuing toxicity from that event. I don't think we yet
know at the beginning of the program that as important as it is to mark and register the grief, that it's also a moment to, in some way, readdress the resolve to look at how this came about. I'm curious to know from your own perspective and gathering together all the information, all the research that you did to sort of sketch in, color in the terrorist side of this story. You're persuaded that will is there.
I'm sorry, that will?
Whether or not the will to pursue the terrorists is there at the top level, but also at the public level.
Yeah. It's almost impossible question to answer. I don't have any way of measuring the will. I certainly feel that September 11th brought a profound change in the public discourse and in the public's awareness of the nature of this force out there that in the name of God, this perverted notion of God that threatens us. And one of the fascinating and disturbing things to do about researching this whole issue is to see how clear and how numerous the signs were that they were out to get us. I mean, some of them so amazingly conspicuous. In 1998, Osama bin Laden issued a fatwa, an Islamic religious decree, in which he said that he called on Muslims to fulfill God's wish to kill Americans wherever they could be found. And a few months later, Al-Qaeda bombed, mounted simultaneous car bombings against the American embassies in Nairobi and Kenya, one in which 250 people were killed, most of them not Americans, only 11 Americans. Most of them were just people who happened to be walking by at the moment, African people from Kenya and from Tanzania who had absolutely nothing to do with any of Al-Qaeda's grievances, and yet they were struck down. You could go all the way back to 1989 when the FBI was tracking a group of radical men from a mosque in Brooklyn. They tracked them out to the Calverton shooting range in eastern Long Island and watched them do a military drill. Several of the people that they observed in that military drill were later involved in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. At that point, this blind Egyptian cleric, Omar Abdul Rahman, had arrived in the United States. In 1990, he arrived in the United States. Well, he was a man who had a long association with Osama bin Laden and with the group that Osama bin Laden was organizing and was part of in Pakistan. So there are all these connections that go back 20 years. But until we were struck in this devastating way, there wasn't the popular awareness, and there wasn't really, I don't think, the political will to fight back and to make sure that something like this didn't happen
again.
No,
you're so right. I mean, we talk about this day as a narrative that began on September 11th, 2001, and without looking further back beyond that, we're missing such a large part of the story. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bob's joining us. Bob? Hi, Bob. Are you there?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
I'm just calling to share an observation. I am just kind of amazed. I'm a psychologist. I'm amazed by the ability of the human being and the human spirit to not only recall but to re-experience the very same feelings that I had, at least this is what's happening for me, last year at the same time, which is a very unique swirl of anger and sadness and profound grief. And I just think it's quite remarkable that the same, very same feelings come back to us, and that, to me, it provides us an opportunity to heal by having the feelings again and to understand them, put the pieces together.
Just stay with us for a minute, if you would, Bob, because I want to bring Marie Howe onto the program. Marie joined us in the autumn of last year on a program that we were doing, talking about the writers and the poets and the way that they reflect on what happened September 11, 2001. And Marie is on the streets of New York on her cell phone as we speak now. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I wanted to bring you in while Bob was on the line, in part because the work, the writing that you do, that collection of poems, What the Living Do, in many ways speaks so specifically to this sense of wonder or curiosity that we have about how we all respond.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing I have to tell you guys is that I'm at Union Square right now, surrounded by a lot of the living. There are hundreds and hundreds of people right now walking around Union Square. There's just been a silent lie-down mourning during the periods from 8:46 to 10:29, from when the first plane hit to when the second building fell. A whole bunch of people were lying down silently. Mourning for those people who died here in the United States, and mourning for those who died in Afghanistan as a result of the military response to this. And in Union Square, all over, there once again, there are walls that people are writing on. There are pieces of paper you can write on, and you can tack them up. And it's just an extraordinary expression of democracy here. Every possible emotion is represented, as is, of course, every race, color, creed, every kind of person.
And do you find that either within yourself or as in terms of what you see, Marie, that the reexamination of where we've been over the past year?
I have to tell you, I'm very, very moved by how many of these signs speak to one world, speak to an identification with the Afghani and Iraqi people. I really didn't expect this much. I'm looking right now at a sign that says hate with a line through it, and then a big heart, and a sign above that, a whole bunch, someone, a child drew it, I think, all these people holding hands that says we are one. There's one of the signs that says Arabs died too, we love you, love us. I mean, we're in New York, right? Everybody here is from another country. It's the ultimate world city, and I think that there's something deeply in the heart of many New Yorkers that we know that, well, another sign says one blood. Another sign says one sky. One of the signs says no war over here, over there. We're human beings everywhere.
Let me just go back to Bob in Cambridge. Bob, I mean, you're talking about that the re-examination. Do you do it? As an American, very conscious of patriotism, do you do it in a manner, in any way, like Marie is describing from where she is in New York City, with a sort of bigger sense of citizens of the world?
For me, it's much more a bigger sense of the citizens of the world. It's clearly something that reaches beyond our borders, our country, myself, and into the entire world. And I feel a sense of connection to within those feelings that I mentioned earlier. I do feel a sense of deep connection to all the people in the world.
Bob, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And to Boston, Massachusetts, Adam is joining us. Adam, hi.
Yeah, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Yeah, I was calling. I just want to make a comment, kind of piggyback on some of the things that you talked about how there were and had been signs to what was leading up to what eventually happened on September 11th.
Right.
I was in the Air Force for 10 years, and I would say within those 10 years, probably 8, maybe 7 years of that time, there was a very strong knowledge of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and for some ways it was very personal for me. I had friends that were killed in the Dahran bombings that took place in 1996, as well as to be involved in certain operations. And we tried, although I think politically half-heartedly, to really try to stop bin Laden. And for a lot of people to say, how did this happen, and you know, why did it happen to us, I think in a lot of ways it was naive, because we were kind of sheltered as Americans, for the most part, from the realities of groups that are out there that have the will and the way to hit us very strongly.
So was part of you this time, 1 year ago, thinking to yourself, we saw it coming, I told you so?
Well, in a way, yeah. I'm now an airline pilot, and I was working up until I came home on the night of the 10th, and I remember very distinctly the night before. I was sitting with the man I was flying with. We were in Washington, D.C., and he was a Vietnam veteran, and we were talking a lot about what was going to happen, and what event was going to galvanize our nation. And, you know, I'm no, you know, sage or anything, but, you know, for it to happen the next day, I was shocked, you know, like everybody, you know, and scared for my friends, wondering, you know, if the guys that were hijacked or guys that I knew. But at the same time, I really wasn't surprised. And I used to say to my friends, you know, after watching the movie The Siege with Denzel Washington and Annette Bening, I said, you know, it is just a matter of time before we experience this here. The sad part was we experienced it on such a dramatic and grand scale right off the bat that it was that much more frightening to everybody.
Adam, thanks for your call.
No problem. Thanks.
Now, Marie, where do you go for the rest of the day? Marie Howe in New York.
Well, I go for a cup of coffee, and then I go up to teach poetry at Sarah Lawrence today. I meet with my first graduate class, and we get to think about the power of language during this crucial time in the world's history. Poetry is a great thing because it says what it means.
I'd love to be in that class today, Marie. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Forbes, power of language, something that faces you, I guess faces you this evening, your first opportunity to speak publicly on this day?
That's right. Actually, it started earlier today at an interfaith service at St. Bartholomew's.
The prayer breakfast,
At a prayer breakfast with the United Nations representatives. And then there's going to be another service at 2 o'clock, Port of Authority of New York and New Jersey, a memorial service at Riverside. Afternoon services of remembrance where people will come, light candles, and offer prayers. And then at 7 o'clock, the first opportunity to give a word, and that word is going to be about the courage to sing again. It's as if we were required to put on hold the joyful and the normal hopefulness of our lives as we lived through that horror. Now, 1 year later, we are discovering that we are not really completely safe. Thank God we are safer and there's more alertness than was the case before, but we do not know what the future holds. But with our sobriety, having looked at the problems of the world, knowing the clashes amongst religions and races, we've got a basis on which we can still sing about a world in which religion and class and ethnicity will not divide us. And we cannot wait until things are perfect. We've got to find a way to dream again, to hope, to get on with our lives, and to make some space for joy, even in the midst of these days of new vulnerability.
You know, and as big and daunting as the world has appeared so often over the past year, it's also remarkably small, because you were speaking earlier in the program about Andrew Rice, a young man who was a student of yours, and we're joined on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts, by Gwen, who's called in. And Gwen, Andrew Rice was your son's teacher, is that right?
He was my son's babysitter. He was, while he was studying at the Divinity School, he was a teacher at the daycare center next door to the Divinity School, and he taught my son when he was 2 years old. He was the sweetest young man. I'm sorry. I didn't know he was there until just when I heard it. I heard Reverend Forbes mention him. He was an aspiring filmmaker. He mustn't have been 30 years old yet. He was such a sweet, sweet young man. I just wanted to pay tribute to him. I didn't know that he had died.
And you have. Thank you for your call.
Thanks.
Richard, one of the things that draws the political side, the spiritual side, the emotional side, and the harder news side of it all together is that sense of narrative, that 1 year out, the narrative is much clearer than it was a year ago, but still very much being written in terms of what September 11th is going to mean to our children.
That's true. I mean, there are many narratives. You could say that there are more than 3,000 narratives, certainly. Your caller just a minute ago, who just learned about the death of her son's babysitter, that was extraordinarily moving to me, because it brought home again the concreteness of this event, the fact that you can't think of it as in the abstract, that it was real people who were in those towers and who died. That's part of the narrative. And then, of course, the other part of the narrative is how it happened. Pieces of the puzzle are still falling together. There's a piece in the Times yesterday that I had a hand in writing about the newest information that we have.